When I first quit drinking, I tended to see my anorexic years as essentially abstemious, a period when I drank very little, if at all. In fact, I drank quite a lot. I just compressed the drinking into shorter periods of time, spaced it out into intense, sporadic bursts. Periodically, about once every 4 to 6 weeks, I simply couldn't stand the starving anymore, couldn't go on without some kind of release from the absolute rigor and vigilance and self-control. And I'd go out and eat like crazy and drink like crazy. The technical term for that behavior is binging, binge eating and binge drinking, and engaging in it always made me feel awful. Plus, it wasn't working, not the starving, not the binging. As happens with most addictions, life took on a blank sameness, each day ritualized and invariable, barely distinguishable from the day before. 2.5 years passed this way. I was 22, 23, 24. I had no real friends to speak of, no sex life, and the only semblance of fun I had came in the form of a bottle, in the rare moment when I'd find myself sitting at a bar stool with a buddy from work and relaxing into a glass of white wine. If anything, drinking felt helpful to me during those years, providing a periodic push out of the isolation of starving. And compared to the way I lived most days, that seemed like a good thing, a healthy thing. In the fall of 1984, I left Providence for Boston and began the slow and arduous process of wending my way out of anorexia and into some more normal relationship with food and the world. There was nothing clear or simple about this process, certainly nothing easy. I don't think you can really get out of anorexia, or any addiction for that matter, until you simply have no other choice, until the sense that your back's against the wall grows too strong and too irrefutable. Until you're simply in too much pain, too desperate and deeply bored and unhappy to go on. I started seeing a therapist, whom I still see today, and he pressed me to let go of my rigidity in tiny ways, to learn to tolerate discomfort through little test runs with change. Small things like eating 2 bagels instead of 1 in the morning. Bigger things like going out to dinner with people instead of choosing to stay home alone in isolation. What I couldn't see at that time, what I wouldn't see until after I'd quit drinking, was how central a role alcohol played in that process. If you'd plotted my eating and drinking on a graph in the first few years after I left Providence, you'd see the two lines creeping up simultaneously. More eating, more drinking. For a long time, the two behaviors overlapped. I started dating again, usually going out with men who were way too old for me, or newly divorced, or somehow damaged or inappropriate. And I'd meet one of them for dinner, eat a relatively normal meal, then stop at a convenience store on my way home and buy candy. I'd buy Snickers bars and Cadbury cream-filled chocolate eggs, and I'd unwrap them in a frenzy in the car and stuff them down, trying to assuage a feeling of deep hunger, a profound discomfort that I couldn't quite identify and certainly couldn't address in any other way. Sometimes, driven by exactly the same impulse, I'd stop at a liquor store, too, and pick up a nip of brandy, or 2 or 3. But the drinking felt like progress. Anorexia had demanded so much privacy and isolation, and at least I could look at my life and see myself climbing out of the cage. Given how painful it was to surrender that seclusion, it was probably inevitable that any return to the world, any resumption of a social life, would require the resumption of my armor, my protection. So I picked up where I left off, drinking. In retrospect, I guess you could say the drinking worked, at least superficially. I gained back the weight I'd lost. I went out to parties and restaurants and bars. But all I'd really done was change substances. Same dance, new shoes. You often hear in AA meetings that denial is the disease of alcoholism, not just its primary symptom, and it's not hard to see why. Denial is what keeps you in there, keeps you entrenched, keeps your feet glued to the floor. Denial can make your drinking feel as elusive and changeable as the Hydra, many-headed, capable of altering form in the blink of an eye. Every time an active alcoholic looks at his or her drinking, it's shifted into something else, something that makes it seem acceptable. Not long ago, I heard a young woman talk in a meeting about drinking a beer in her car on the way home from work. No big deal, drinking a beer in the car. Except that abstaining from alcohol while driving had been one of her rules. If she drank in the car, it meant she had a problem. I'd always thought that was a really bad thing to do, she said. But then I figured, if I was having a beer in the car, it couldn't be that bad, so I changed the rule. Nods all around. We all did it. We all had our version of the changing rule. Many versions, too many to count. And that's how denial works. You see yourself doing things you shouldn't do, things you don't want to do, things that muck up your life or put you in danger, and you keep drinking. I kept drinking too, which may be why my mid-20s, post-anorexic but increasingly liquid, are all muddy to me. I primarily remember the outlines. After I left Providence, I moved into an apartment in Newton, just west of Boston, and started hanging around with Elaine, who lived next door. I got a job at a small business-oriented weekly newspaper. I met my friend Sam at a cocktail party, aptly enough, and started drinking with him at the Ritz. I even did some healthy things, joined a woman support group, took up sculling on the Charles River, a difficult and demanding sport that gave me something to master besides my own appetite. Beyond that, the details are hazy. I know I was depressed, but somewhere halfway between anorexia and alcoholism, I couldn't figure out why I was so unhappy and overcome with inertia. I went through a heavy pot-smoking period around then, my mid-20s, and I'd shut myself up in my apartment a few nights each week, smoke a joint, then sit there listening to music, my mind flashing with those pot-induced insights that seem deeply profound when you're stoned and utterly banal the next morning. I once developed an entire theory of personality based on the fact that my mother wore glasses. Once in a while, I'd have a stoned insight about my drug and alcohol use, too, but I never wrote those down, let alone acted on them. For the most part, I had the chronic sensation that I was sitting around waiting for my life to begin, and I'd sit there in my shrink's office every week and writhe with self-pity, as whiny and self-absorbed as a 6-year-old. I don't know what to do. I'm still surprised I didn't bore him to death right there in his office. Drinking was the one constant during those years. Drinking and worrying about it, then not worrying. Drinking and questioning and then shutting the questions down. One summer night in 1986, I ran across a street in Harvard Square and caught a glimpse of myself in the glass of a store window. I didn't recognize the image at first. I'd been at a bar having a drink with a friend after work, and I was running to my car on my way to meet Sam. And I saw the reflection out of the corner of my eye, a neatly dressed young woman with a blunt shoulder-length haircut, a short white skirt and oversized cotton sweater, and fashionable black pumps. I was a little drunk at the time, and I remember that a question formed in my mind. I thought, am I as together as I look, or am I going crazy? But the question didn't linger. I got in my car, drove across town in a hurry, and went to the Ritz. For the time being, anyway, I'd settled on an answer. I'm fine, perfectly together, not crazy. Sometimes, though, at the end of a night of drinking, I'd stagger into the ladies' room and think, something is wrong with this picture. To get to the bathroom at the Ritz, you had to walk through the lobby and down a set of stairs. And I remember navigating that path one night in a pair of high heels over soft carpeting. It was late in the evening, and I'd probably had 7 or 8 glasses of wine by then, maybe more. And I reeled across the lobby, bumping into the wall at the top of the staircase. Downstairs, I shut myself in the stall, then leaned over and put my head down on my knees. I was dizzy and drunk, and I knew it, and times like that I'd be aware of the two images of myself, competing and increasingly irreconcilable. There was the sophisticated young woman in the bar sipping an expensive Fumé Blanc, and there was the drunken young woman staggering through the lobby of the hotel, wondering if she was going to puke. Sometimes I'd be so drunk at the end of the night I'd have to drive home with one eye shut to avoid double vision. Sometimes I'd wake up at Sam's house, in his bed, wearing one of his t-shirts. I don't think we ever had sex, but I can't say for sure. I was always too embarrassed to ask him. So you worry and you deny. You worry and you drink. A light bulb goes on, and then, click, just like that, it goes off again and you're back in the dark, unable to see. Click. Fuck, something is very wrong. I'm in trouble. Click. I'm okay. Fine. Not to worry. My friend Gail, who's a professional chef, used to get up at 5 a.m. and stand in her shower obsessing about what she'd drink that night and when she'd be able to drink and how much and with whom. She did this daily, obsessing in the shower about booze every morning at 5 a.m. And every once in a while the light would go on. Click. And she'd realize this was crazy, a real problem. A genuine sign of dependence that had spiraled way out of control. But she could always counter that observation, always. Bad day ahead, work, stress. I'm all right. I have a job. I pay my bills. I can't be an alcoholic. End of story. That's the thing about denial around alcohol. If Gail were standing there obsessing about, say, asparagus, how she'd get it, when she'd eat it, how many spears she'd have, whether anyone would smell asparagus on her breath, it might have been easier for her to realize she was losing control. But when it comes to an addictive substance like alcohol, something that alters your mind and shapes your sense of self in the world and becomes central to your ability to cope, the mind's capacity to play with the facts can be limitless. I have my reasons, Gail would think. I know I'm obsessing and I know it's crazy, but I have my reasons. And yes, we all have our reasons. We're bored or we're restless or we're depressed. We're worried or anxious or stressed. We're celebrating or we're grieving. Tomorrow. We'll deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it when things get better. If we hadn't met in sobriety, Gail and I probably would have loved drinking together. Drinkers, after all, find other drinkers. We choose people who speak a certain language. Let's go get a drink. Let's have another. Oh, come on, just one more. This is so easy to do, so frighteningly simple. For a long time, you drink because the drink just seems to be available. And then at some point way down the line, you drink because you make it available. Without being completely aware of it, you organize your life in such a way that alcohol is always there. At the table over dinner, in your cupboard and refrigerator, in the cupboards and refrigerators of your closest friends. You hang out with other drinkers, people who find it perfectly desirable and perfectly normal to down 6 bottles of wine in a single sitting. People who support both the effort and the denial of its consequences. Drinkers know each other. We can pick each other out of a crowd the way new mothers can, or army veterans, or any other members of a group united by the deepest sort of common cause and experience. We seem to be attuned to a kind of music, a chorus of more, and we learn to determine which other people hear it too, which ones understand our special liquid logic, and which ones don't. The drinker who's in a hurry to get the first drink most definitely hears it. The one who looks up 2 minutes after you sat down at a table and snaps, "Where's the damn waitress?" So does the drinker who gulps that first one down, who looks down shortly after the round has arrived and notices the glass is already empty. The chorus plays in the mind, liquid lyrics. The drinker who's always game for another, who'd rather stay and drink than go out and eat, who encourages the rest of the people at the table to keep drinking, who feels secret relief when the non-drinkers in the group pick up their coats and straggle off. That drinker hears the music. About half the alcohol in the U.S. is consumed by 11% of the population. Together, we do a lot of singing. And privately, we do a lot of worrying, especially in the morning. Every alcoholic I know remembers the worried morning after, the dread and the sense of shame that sets in. We'd wake up after a party and we'd lie in bed worrying about what we'd said or done the night before. And finally, we'd call the person who threw the party and hunt for clues to our behavior by gauging the response. "I had way too much to drink last night," we'd say, as though this were a rarity, a fluke. "I hope I didn't do anything too stupid." Pause. "Oh, you were fine." Those are the words I was always looking for. If no one else was worried, I didn't need to be either. The worst for me was wondering what I'd said, what confidences I might have broken, what evil tidbit I might have passed along to someone about a mutual friend, what self-aggrandizing comment I might have tossed off. Sometimes when I got drunk, I could feel my own sober rules of social conduct just melt away, hear a little voice in my head say, "No, don't start talking about that," and then I'd go ahead and talk about it anyway. "Don't repeat this to anyone, but..." Then you wake up in the morning and cringe. Elaine used to call it the uh-ohs. That feeling of waking up in a haze after a night of heavy drinking, regretting things you blabbed about, or not being able to account for whole chunks of time, wondering what you'd done. Uh-oh, did I say something really bad? Have sex with someone? Kill anyone driving home? I was glad she had a name for it. It happened, I supposed, to everyone. Stupid things happen when you're drunk, things that simply wouldn't happen if you were sober, more careful and attentive. Drunk one night, Ernest Hemingway pulled the wrong chain in the bathroom of his apartment and accidentally brought down an entire glass skylight, leaving him with a permanent scar on his forehead. throughout my mid to late 20s, the Elaine and Sam years. Incidents like that happen to me all the time. Little episodes that make you look up and say, oh fuck, what now? I'd leave my car in dangerous places late at night when I drank, and then I'd be shocked, shocked, to find it had been broken into, all my stuff stolen. I lost things. My favorite winter coat at a Christmas party in the Bostonian Hotel, my wallet in a bar, a pair of earrings my sister had given me while I rambled drunkenly home from a restaurant. I blamed these things on circumstances beyond my control. Urban living for the car, thievery for the lost coat and wallet. A very complicated dynamic involving the back of the earring and its relationship to the collar of my coat to explain my sister's gift. Like I said, there was always a reason. A lot of alcoholics talk about how they look back and can see that they never really could predict when they'd get too drunk, when they'd cross the line from what felt like normal heavy drinking into raging, out-of-control drinking. It was just something that happened, happened to us. In AA meetings, you often hear the phrase, bad things didn't happen every time I drank, but every time something bad did happen, drinking was involved. If you're an active alcoholic, you focus in on the times when bad things didn't happen, when you went out drinking and had a good time, got home safely, woke up in your own bed. And when those more destructive or embarrassing episodes occur, when you open your eyes in the morning and can't remember what happened the night before, well, you make excuses. Find someone or something else to blame. Pressure, life, hormones, and you keep drinking. Liquor creates delusion. It can make your life feel full of risk and adventure, sparkling and dynamic as a rough sea under sunlight. A single drink can make you feel unstoppable, masterful, capable of solving problems that overwhelmed you just 5 minutes before. In fact, the opposite is true. Drinking brings your life to a standstill, makes it static as a rock over time. For years, I could see that truth in other people, but not in myself. I could see it in my friend Elaine, the way her drinking seemed to stand in the way of any real opportunity she had to grow or change or learn from her own experience. She's too out of it to have a healthy relationship, I'd think, feeling smug. She drinks too much. She doesn't know who the hell she is. Elaine had been involved with a married man for 3 years when I met her, and she talked about him constantly. Brian this and Brian that. She adored him, or thought she did, but she also blamed him relentlessly for all her unhappiness, for a despair that seemed far more deeply rooted to me. You'd sit down with her at a bar and say, "So how are things with Brian?" And then you'd get a 25-minute blow-by-blow of what happened the last time they were together. The promises he made, the things he said about his marriage, the little seeds of hope he scattered in her path. They broke up at least once every other month and always got back together. I knew on some level that the drinking kept Elaine stuck in that relationship and fueled her tendency to blame her unhappiness on the people and things around her, but I didn't know quite how. She just seemed like a mess to me, stuck and out of control. I met my version of Brian when I was 28, although I couldn't see it that way at the time. His name was Julian, and when we first met, I thought he was an asshole. For reasons that now escape me, one of our first conversations had to do with pâté. We were standing with a group of people at a party where we'd been introduced, and he said something about making pâté. I said, "Oh, my mother makes great pâté every Christmas," and he looked at me and said, "Are you sure it isn't terrine?" Most people don't know the difference. And I thought, what an asshole. Later, I called my mother and told her about that conversation, and she said, "Well, technically he's right. Technically, pâté is baked in a crust." And I thought, feh, he's still an asshole. But then I got a new job, and he came into my office with a bottle of champagne to celebrate. And a week or so later, when he called me up to ask me to dinner, I thought, well, maybe he's not that bad, and I said, okay. We drank together right from the start. We drank elegant reds and crisp whites, and we drank things I'd never heard of, like Ricard, a French aperitif that Julian would mix in small glasses with water until it turned a soft, cloudy yellow. The first time he cooked me dinner, he grilled lamb with rosemary, and we sat on his patio after we ate and drank brandy and listened to Bach violin concertos on his portable tape player. The first time I spent the night at his house, he got up in the morning and made waffles from scratch and sprinkled them with cognac. I thought that was just about the best breakfast treat imaginable. Julian was an art dealer, urbane and cerebral, and yet sensual, too. a man who appreciated fine things. He looked like a new solution to an old set of puzzles, a person who could help me learn to feed myself with pleasure instead of anxiety, who could teach me to merge the intellect I'd grown up with and the passion I'd felt lacking. I watched him at the counter cooking those waffles, and a light seemed to go off in my head. I thought, here it is, new life. Of course, attaching all your hopes and fantasies to something or someone outside yourself almost always had disastrous results. I'd seen it in Elaine, and I'd seen it in myself, the way I'd tried to reshape my own body into something that felt special, the way I'd coveted approval from men in order to feel worthy, and I saw myself doing the same thing with Julian. But it felt so real this time. The new life seemed so accessible that I ignored the obvious parallels. Julian seemed like someone who had access to all the things I wanted and felt I lacked in my own life, a worldliness, a confidence. And after a while, I found myself clinging to him in the most desperate way, truly believing I could not acquire those traits without him. I remember standing in his living room one day watching him iron a shirt and having the thought that he would change my life, that he was capable of changing my life, and it would happen just like that. We would live together in the city, a creative young couple, and we would cook wonderful meals together and drink wonderful wine, and all his confidence and sophistication would rub off on me, just ooze into me, a kind of emotional osmosis. The fantasy touched me on the deepest level, and a few months later, when he looked up at me over dinner one night and said, "I've been thinking we ought to get a place together," I felt like I'd won the relationship version of a Nobel Prize, been bestowed a top honor, found my way, found myself, at last. We celebrated with wine. And the relationship fell apart almost immediately. My sister got married in May of 1989, about a year after I met Julian. I cried at the wedding. Actually, I wept, not because I was happy for her, I wasn't, and not because weddings make me cry, they don't, but because I got drunk in maudlin and I wanted to lie down on my parents' front lawn and die. This didn't happen until the very last minutes of the reception. Up until then, I pretended I was fine, even though I secretly wanted to kill someone, or tear off my dress and run screaming into the street. Julian and I were miserable together by then, and I hated weddings. I hated weddings, and I hated birth announcements, and I hated reading chipper little entries about my peers in the class notes section of my college alumni bulletin. And I quietly loathed people who got job promotions or bought new houses or relocated to swell new cities. Events like that were irrefutable pieces of evidence to me, indications that all around me people were getting on with their lives while I seemed to stand still, immobile. My sister's wedding, of course, was a particularly striking indication. She'd graduated from medical school at Boston University just a week earlier, and I'd watched my father stand up on a stage and hand her diploma, literally passing her the psychiatric mantle. Traditionally, there were two routes to approval in my family. You went to medical school or you got married. In the course of a week, my sister, my twin, had done both, and I felt like she was sailing across the finish line before I'd even made it out of the gate. I also hated my dress, hated it. All the siblings were in the wedding, five of us altogether, and we were told we could wear anything we wanted, so I had a dress made. A pale pink dress that I'd had modeled after something Julian had seen in a magazine. Julian and I had been living together for about 8 months by then, and we'd gone to see my therapist together shortly before Becca's wedding, far too late as it turned out. The therapist asked Julian, "What do you love about Caroline? What is it that really keeps you in there?" And Julian sat back and thought for a minute. "Well," he said, "Caroline is like a really good bottle of wine. You can appreciate all the qualities and all the nuances, but you're just not sure you want to drink it every night." It took me several years to realize how angry that comment made me, because at the time a part of me believed him, believed that I was like a good bottle of wine, but not a great one, and I was expending a whole lot of energy trying to rearrange my packaging, trying to change the label, so to speak, and make us both believe I was worthy, hence the dress. Julian found the seamstress, and he found the dress in an Ungaro ad in Vogue, and he took me to see the dressmaker one night after work. And on some level, I think I truly believed that if I had exactly the right dress and looked exactly the way he imagined, it would be the two of us getting married, not Becca and Andy. Julian fueled this perception, although perhaps not consciously. He had definite opinions about me, more definite than my own. One time, about 3 weeks before we moved in together, he sat me down and said, "Okay, there are three things you can do for me." He paused and said, "One, buy a new winter coat. Two, get your hair highlighted. And three, don't wear any of my clothes unless they look good on you." I looked down. We'd been watching a movie in his bedroom where it was cold, and I pulled on an old sweater of his that had been lying on the floor, a tattered thing that apparently didn't suit me. We stayed up until 2 a.m. that night, Julian expressing wagon loads of doubts about me. He thought I wasn't doing enough to keep him attracted to me. He was worried about getting stuck in a rut, and although a part of me was furious at him, a bigger part of me was scared that he was right. The next day I went into work and banged off a long, articulate letter to him about my own worries, which were mounting. And then the fearful part kicked in. In the end, I trashed the letter, went over to his apartment, let myself in with my key, scrubbed the place clean, and left flowers with a note apologizing for disappointing him. Within the space of a few months, I had little streaks of blonde in my hair and a brand new black wool coat that he helped select, a very classic cut, he said. And I only wore his clothes after very careful deliberation. As it turned out, the dress I wore to Becca's wedding was all wrong. It was supposed to be off the shoulder, but it was cut too low, so it was way off the shoulder, and it kept slipping down, off one shoulder, then off the other. I had to keep hiking it up to keep my breasts from falling out. Plus, it was too tight, so I had to suck in my stomach all day, and the seamstress and I had picked the wrong fabric, a lightweight wool that wrinkled terribly. So by the time Julian and I drove from our apartment to my parents' house where the wedding was, the dress was all crinkled around my waist and hips, like an accordion. I hated it. I stood there during the ceremony with the heels of my pumps sinking into the grass, and I felt like an idiot. I was pretty scared of Julian by then. We fought about our relationship all the time, and big walls of anger had sprung up between us. Sometimes it was me who exploded, and sometimes it was him, and we couldn't seem to go a week without some fuse being ignited, setting off a chain reaction of rage. When we saw the therapist together, he always talked about my potential. "Caroline has a lot of potential," he said to the shrink. "But I honestly don't know how long I can wait around until it's realized." Julian was a brutally honest person, and he meant that in the most factual sense. He loved me, but he saw me as a fragile, insecure, and muddled person who needed to grow into a strong person. He was right, of course. I was fragile and insecure and muddled, so I never felt I could argue the point. But I also hated him for saying that, hated him for loving the person he wanted me to become instead of loving just me, and I wanted to shoot him at Becca's wedding. He was better dressed than me, and he seemed more comfortable and chatty with my relatives than I was. Moving about from circle to circle, smiling and acting charming with strangers the way he used to act with me, I chugged champagne and stood next to him, hoping we looked like a nice, sophisticated couple and knowing that we weren't. At the very end, as we were about to leave, I hugged my sister and burst into tears. I was crying because my mother seemed so proud of her, and I was crying because my father had stood up on a chair and made a speech, and I was crying because I felt like the loser sister beside her, the loser sister who couldn't even pay someone to make a dress that fit right, who couldn't do anything except fight with her boyfriend. The pale pink dress I wore to the wedding was actually the world's second worst dress. The world's absolute worst dress was a scrunchy black mini dress made of lycra that looked like a long tube sock when you held it up in front of you. Julian saw it in a women's clothing store on Newbury Street shortly after we moved in together, and he took me to see it one weekend. "You'd look great in that," he said. I tried it on and came out of the dressing room feeling half naked, like I was wearing a small, slippery black towel. "It looks great," he said. So I bought it. I wore it to a New Year's Eve party a few weeks later, and I looked like a cheap imitation of a Victoria's Secret model. The dress had a wide scoop neck and long sleeves, and if you stretched it way down, it came to about mid-thigh. But it was made of really tight, elastic material, so it kept riding up higher than that. I spent the whole night clutching my wine glass and tugging at the hem. Before the party, Julian and I had had an argument because I'd left some mushrooms in the oven too long, and he'd accused me of ruining dinner. So I was feeling alone at the party, as well as self-conscious. I stood there teetering on my black high heels and tugging at the damn hem and feeling exposed, and if I hadn't had a lot to drink, I probably would have burst into tears or lain down on the carpet and died of shame. We spent an inordinate amount of time arguing about my wardrobe, which was really a metaphor for arguing about me, who I was, who both of us wanted me to be. Julian would bring home copies of Vogue and Elle and Harper's Bazaar, and he'd flip through the pages in the kitchen and point at different outfits. "You should think about this look," he'd say, or "that look would be good for you." This would stir up a million different emotions on my part. I'd feel criticized and belittled as though my own clothes weren't good enough, and then I'd feel anxious and insecure as though there was something wrong with my own taste, and I'd flip back and forth between wanting him to tell me how to dress but hating him for doing it. At least once a month I'd call my sister in tears. Julian and I had a fight, I'd sniffle, and then I'd start to sob. It never occurred to me that the drinking and the tears were connected, and it took me years to understand that the drinking and the deteriorating relationship with Julian were connected too, so deeply entangled that I'd never give up one without giving up the other first. Becca saw that long before I did, saw how connected they were, and once in a while she'd tell me. I'd call her up, feeling really sad and stuck, and she'd say, "I don't think you're going to get out of that relationship unless you quit drinking." But I couldn't see that. I thought she was being simplistic and judgmental, and besides, most of the time I thought I'd die without either Julian or alcohol, so I hung in there for a very long time, 5 more years. As a rule, active alcoholics are powerless people, or at least a lot of us tend to feel that way in our hearts. That's something you usually can't tell from looking, especially when it comes to the high-functioning brand of drinkers, people who manage to hold on to all the trappings of personal power, like jobs and families and intact savings accounts. But you have to step back and look beneath the facades. In fact, very few people who drink alcoholically can learn to feel like powerful players in their own lives. All the strength comes out of a bottle. I felt powerless with Julian, and so I drank, and the drinking created another feeling of power. A false one, perhaps, but the only one I had access to. By the time we moved in together, I was inhibited in front of Julian nearly all the time, and intimidated by him, and deeply afraid that he'd leave me. When we came home at the end of the workday, I reached for the bottle of wine like it was a lifeline, because it was the only thing that loosened me up enough around him to relax. I had the exact same feeling of voicelessness I'd had with my father all those years ago, and I reached for the same tool to counter it. We drank every night. Julian, who was a great wine aficionado, would often open 2 bottles of wine so he could compare and contrast. He'd pour tiny amounts into a glass and swirl it and hold it up to the light. He'd comment on the wine's nose or its legs, and he'd often quiz me on different vintages. "What do you taste?" he'd ask, wanting me to say something specific like undertones of blackberry or a hint of tarriness. I usually tried to fake my way through these tests, but inside I'd be thinking, "Just pour the fucking wine," and I'd resent him for meting out these stingy little sips. I wouldn't admit it, but after a while I really couldn't care less about the difference between a fine Bordeaux and a mediocre Burgundy, and when he wasn't looking I'd reach for the bottle and fill my glass all the way to the top. Over the years I've learned to detest the phrase low self-image, that and low self-esteem. What do these mean, low self-image and self-esteem? Too many women to count, and a good number of men, careen into relationships every day with people who make them feel worthless, with people who help reinforce all their worst fears about themselves. "You're hideous, unlovable, horribly flawed, and if you're lucky for anything, it's that I continue to tolerate you against my better judgment." These feelings don't come from anything as banal as low self-image. They stem from self-loathing, the deepest, most core variety. And in itself, that feeling becomes addictive, a way of clinging to a truly hateful image of the self. I clung to Julian because I thought he saw and acknowledged the real me, the hideous, unlovable, flawed person I really was, and I wanted him to love me in spite of that. I clung to him because I figured that sooner or later he'd stop tolerating me and leave, and I clung to him because the alternative was too scary. In order to leave him, I would have had to form a vision of myself as worthy and valuable, and I would have had to acknowledge the depth of my own rage, the sparks of fury I felt each time he implied I wasn't good enough. I don't know where that depth of self-loathing came from, really. In the end, I suppose it doesn't matter. At the time, the relationship with Julian felt more addictive than the drink. My world got smaller and smaller. Julian occupied more and more space in my head. and I'd spend whole days at work worrying about him, what he'd said to me, what I'd said back, what this comment or allusion might have meant. I found it harder and harder to spend time with other people, harder to care about anything else. The summer after my sister's wedding, my mother's doctor discovered tumors on her spine and skull, a recurrence of the cancer for which she'd been treated in 1982. She was treated with radiation and started on the drug tamoxifen, and I went to see her oncologist that summer with my brother and sister to talk about her prognosis. The doctor was both direct and cryptic. He told us the cancer would ultimately kill her, but he wouldn't guess when. It could be 2 years, he said. It could be 10. My sister, just out of medical school and far more familiar with cancer statistics than I was, panicked. Apparently the 2-year prognosis was much more likely than the 10-year one, but I couldn't fathom the possibility. I was too self-absorbed, too entrenched in my own problems, and far too focused on Julian to make room for anything else. I spent appallingly little time that summer thinking about my mother's health. I did, however, think a great deal about my parents' marriage. My father and I periodically had lunch together, and every once in a while I'd ask him how things were between him and my mother. They'd gone into couple therapy together after my mother nearly left him, and they seemed to have made some sort of peace. My father was never specific. "We're managing," he'd say, or "things are okay." But I gathered that they'd learned to live with each other's limits, to tolerate a modicum of dissatisfaction in order to hold on to the things they shared. Their intellectual alliance, their love of Martha's Vineyard, us kids. That didn't seem like enough to me. I'd go over to their house and I'd find them in the living room in the same strained, withholding silence, and I'd think, I want more than this. Julian and I certainly didn't seem any happier than my parents, but the kind of contact we had, volatile and enmeshed as it was, felt oddly life-sustaining to me. Angry words seemed better than no words. Rage seemed somehow more tangible than mere tolerance. Julian gave my life shape, and even if the contours became uglier and more distorted over time, the relationship provided me with a focus, gave my existence an edge that seemed more desirable than the veiled, shadowy unhappiness I still sensed between my parents. Even through the fighting, Julian was always a voice on the phone during the workday, a person to please at home, a goal, a companion, and, of course, an object of obsession. I often couldn't sleep at night while I was living with him, and I took to creeping downstairs at 1 or 2 in the morning and sitting in the living room with a bottle of cognac. I'd stare out the window and worry. What was happening? Why were we so angry at each other all the time? Why was I so scared of him and so furious and confused? But when you drink to deal with feelings, it's impossible to get through them. When you drink to drown out fear and rage and confusion, you quite literally disassociate from them, and you stop trusting yourself, stop trusting your own judgment and integrity. You just wake up in the morning and repeat the same behavior as the day before. The shape of addiction is circular. One night, Julian and I went to a cocktail party together, then moved on to a bar in downtown Boston to get a drink and something to eat. Sitting across the table, Julian looked at me suddenly and asked a weird question. If you could get rid of one piece of my clothing, which one would you choose? I didn't know what to say. He had good taste in clothing. Everything he wore looked fine. But when I drank, I couldn't just walk away from a dangerous or provocative situation. I always took the bait, and I always found a way to fan the fire. So after I passed on answering his question, I lit a cigarette and said, "So, if you could get rid of one piece of my clothing, which would you choose?" I was pissed off that night, and I was drunk, and I wanted to be more pissed. And I got what I asked for. Julian answered, "That green shirt you wear when you work out." Then he added, "At the very least, you should tuck it in when you wear it." Add venom and stir, my own personal recipe for rage. I sat there and pictured him actually criticizing my workout attire, and I was so angry I thought I'd burst. We left the bar almost immediately and had a huge fight on the way home, a major screaming brawl about our relationship that lasted for hours. Whose needs weren't being met, who was disappointing whom, the whole 9 yards of accusatory drama. At some point, Julian looked at me and said, "I don't think we should live together anymore. I've had it." Julian was right, of course. We shouldn't have been living together. We were making each other miserable. But when I woke up in the morning, everything seemed wrong and surreal. The rage had faded away, and all I could recall clearly was the stupid conversation about clothing, the screaming, the feeling of being out of control, the fear of being left. I didn't remember half the things we'd said to each other, and I knew that my own anger had come out in a flood instead of a measured, rational stream. And all I wanted to do was take the night back, take back all the words and start over. I always felt messed up and confused like that the day after a fight with Julian, as though I'd been transported to some other planet during the night where people went crazy and lost their senses. I'd call my girlfriends and obsess over every detail of every last fight, and they'd say all the reassuring things you'd expect. It's not all your fault. You deserve to be happy. But inside, I wouldn't believe it. When I got drunk and fought with Julian, I felt like a volcano, spewing out all my worst qualities, anger and insecurity and venom. I felt like a bad person, and because Julian was the only person who saw how bad I was, I felt like he was the only person who really knew me, the real me. The self-loathing would bubble up, and so would the fear that he'd leave me, and I'd be afraid to tell the truth. I'm a terrible girlfriend. I can't even wear workout clothes the right way. After that fight, I started looking for a new apartment. I was miserable, and I drank more. Who wouldn't? I needed to drink. You'd drink, too, if you had my problems. That's the thinking. I'm not unhappy because I drink. I drink because I am unhappy. That is the logic, and every alcoholic on the planet uses it. And so the pattern becomes more deeply entrenched, and so the drinking continues, increases, spirals onward. Time passes, nothing changes. You wait, and while you're waiting, you drink. And while you drink, you get more stuck. Almost everyone I know who's quit drinking describes that same feeling, the sense that life has turned stale and colorless and slowly ground to a halt. You're someplace you don't want to be, a bad job, a bad relationship, and you simply can't fathom a way out, can't see what steps you could take to change things. The pain becomes acute. You wake up after another night of heavy drinking and you can't put the pieces back together. Can't figure out what the fight was about, or why you ended up in the bed you're in, or what happened the night before. And you don't understand, you simply do not understand, why you're so miserable, so depressed and full of hate. And so you drink again. Of course you drink again. Drinking is the one sure way, the only way, to kill the feeling. The circle closes in on itself. The cycle is repeated. You are smack in the middle of the dance of addiction, and you can't find your way off the floor. Julian practically had to pry my fingernails out of the furniture and throw me out of the apartment. I was that desperate to hang on. I clung. I wept and railed. I wrote him long apologetic letters promising I'd change. In the end, I did move, just a few days shy of my 30th birthday. I found an apartment in a converted warehouse, a smart-looking studio with tall ceilings and a fireplace, and a lovely view of the Boston skyline. A very pretty place, but that really wasn't the point. I chose the apartment because it was around the corner from Julian's, half a block away, 65 steps. I counted. But sometimes, even when you're that stuck, you can see the way out, a glimmer of truth. A few weeks after I moved, I called my therapist from work and scheduled an emergency appointment. "Do you have any free time today?" I asked. My voice cracked, and he must have sensed the urgency. He agreed to meet me that afternoon at 2. The therapist's office is on the 7th floor of the Mass General, a small room that overlooks the roof of a Holiday Inn across the street. I sat there and looked out at huge clouds of steam streaming out from the vents on the roof. I was so hungover I thought I'd either die or throw up. I said, "I think I'm having a real problem with alcohol." I said this in a straightforward manner, without much emotion, but I know I was scared. He sat back and said, "What's going on?" I shook my head. Same old story, fight with Julian. We were still seeing each other, and we'd had one of those drunken, screaming brawls the night before about everything and nothing, and I'd woken up in the morning with foggy memories, little threads of them, screaming in the kitchen, leaving, slamming the door, reeling home in the night toward my apartment, weeping, calling him on the phone when I got home to fight and weep some more, to make him understand how hurt I was, hearing the phone just ring and ring because he refused to answer, finally falling into bed. I looked at the therapist, who'd heard me rage and bitch about Julian for more than a year, and I said, "Alcohol is always involved when we fight. I'm drunk every single time. I lose control." I felt some relief talking to him about drinking. We'd discussed the subject before. Every now and then I'd tell him I thought I was drinking too much, or I'd mention something in which too much wine had played a role, most often a fight with Julian. But I usually skirted my way around the details, justified or minimized the extent to which alcohol was involved. I paused at one point, then asked him in a quiet voice, "Do you think I'm going to have to quit drinking?" My shrink is not the sort of person who makes grand pronouncements or offers direct advice. But he looked at me that afternoon and said, "Yes, I think so." I went back to my office that afternoon, called Alcoholics Anonymous, and determined that there was a meeting that evening in the back bay. The man on the phone said it was a beginner's meeting, and that sounded good. I had an image of lots of young women like me, young professional women who'd be seated comfortably in a room and given literature to read by some kindly, maternal, older woman. The meeting was held in the basement of a church, and it looked nothing like I'd hoped. The room was cavernous and dingy, with rows of metal chairs. Cigarette smoke swirled up from every other seat. Old men sat and sipped coffee from white foam cups. There were a few women there, even a few professional-looking young ones, but the dominant feeling was gray and male and alien. An older man at the podium chaired the meeting, and the first thing he did was ask us to go around the room in turn and introduce ourselves by first name. People said, "I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic," and "I'm Hank, alcoholic." When it was my turn, I just said, "I'm Caroline." Some people in AA talk about going to a meeting for the first time and identifying right away, hearing someone tell what sounds exactly like their own story, having bells and whistles go off from the start. I looked around at the dingy room with the old men sipping coffee from foam cups, and I thought, "No way, no way in hell I'm doing this. This is not for me. I do not belong here." I left the minute the meeting ended. I think I knew I wouldn't go back, but I promised myself, really promised myself, that I'd stop drinking so much, that I'd cut down, get it under control. If I didn't, that smoke-filled church basement would be my fate. I didn't drink that night, not a single drop. Sometimes you see, but you're not ready to act. As it turned out, that would be the only night for the next 5 years that I successfully abstained from alcohol, or for that matter, from Julian. Al-Anon, the 12-step program for friends and family members of alcoholics, estimates that every alcoholic's drinking affects at least 4 other people. We worry parents, lovers, co-workers, anyone close who crosses our path. We lose our tempers with them. We blame them for our troubles. We push them away. We never quite let them in, let them know us too well, because we're afraid that if they got too close, they'd be appalled at what they'd find. Accordingly, a great deal of the active alcoholic's energy is spent constructing facades, an effort to present to others a front that looks okay, that seems lovable and worthy and intact. Inside versus outside. Version A, version B. The double life grows more sophisticated and more deeply entrenched. Mostly we lie. Alcoholics lie about big things, and we lie about small things, and we lie to other people, and above all, we lie to ourselves. John Cheever wrote about this in his journals, calling dishonesty the most despicable trait. He wrote, "You take a nap and claim to be tired from work. You hide a whiskey bottle in the cabinet and claim to be a wiser man than your friends who hide whiskey bottles in the closet. You promise to take a child to the circus and have such a bad hangover that you can't move. You promise to send money to your old mother and do not." Big lies, small lies. It's hard to find an alcoholic who didn't manipulate the truth about something, even if it was minor stuff, stuff that really didn't add up to anything at all. My friend Gail used to lie about movies and books. If a group of people at work were talking about something they'd read, she'd chime in instinctively. "Oh, I read that," she'd say, even if she hadn't. Or she'd say she loved some movie that other people loved, even if she'd never even heard of the movie, let alone seen it. To an outsider, this sounds stupid and useless, until you consider that people who drink constantly never really get a chance to know how they feel about anything, even things like movies and books. After a while, drinkers just fall into the behavior, a way of overcompensating, We learn to pretend we have opinions, because deep in our own hearts we really don't. I met Michael a few months after moving out of Julian's apartment, right around the time I skipped out on that AA meeting. He was Julian's antithesis. For a long time, my friend Eliza called him the anti-Julian because he was so uncomplicated and sweet. Michael was unqualified in his affections, a laid-back, regular guy who drank Budweiser beer and didn't know beans about high fashion. I met him at work. A freelance illustrator, he came into my office one day while I was working on a feature story about women's magazines. I was flipping through a copy of Glamour, and he was standing by my desk when I turned to a page that showed a model wearing a silver net shirt. I heard a shocked voice say, "Whoa, she looks like she's wearing a fireplace screen," and I laughed. That was Michael. He appealed to the part of me that wanted to be with an easy, comfortable, loving man. And at the same time, he conflicted with the part of me that wanted to be with a complicated, cerebral, willful man. And so began a 4-year jag of insanity. Two men, two competing sets of needs, too many drinks. Michael is just about the kindest man I've ever met. The first time I spent the night at his house, he woke up and looked at me, his eyes all earnest, and said, "How did this happen? I feel like I've won the lottery." It was snowing outside hard, but he got up and went to the store and bought eggs and cheese and milk and the newspapers. Then he made omelets, and while he was cooking, he talked to his mother, who'd called on the phone from Connecticut. I remember watching him whisk the eggs and milk in a metal bowl, the phone tucked between his ear and shoulder, and hearing him laugh at something his mother said. He has a great laugh, deep and sincere, and before he got off the phone, he told her he loved her. He didn't seem the least bit awkward or embarrassed by saying that, "I love you, Mom," in front of a woman he'd just spent the night with, and I filed a mental note about that. Nice man, loves his mother. I was like a sponge around him, soaking up all that affection as though I'd been starved. But one of the sick things about being drunk and confused all the time is that a good thing can be staring you in the face and you really can't see it. So many other things cloud the picture. After we ate the omelets that morning, I sat on the sofa and fought with myself about how to spend the day. It was all snowy and gray outside, and the idea of hanging out in Michael's living room watching videos all afternoon seemed infinitely appealing, comforting and soft as something cashmere. But the Julian question loomed, scratched at some internal door. You should get home. What if Julian calls and you're not there? Stay available for Julian. I had mental wars like that all the time, pulled toward Michael, pulled back toward Julian, and I simply didn't have the guts or the presence of mind to be honest about this with either man. "I gotta get home," I finally said to Michael. "I have a million things to do this afternoon." Michael liked to drink, but he wasn't the least bit alcoholic. He always knew when to stop. And at first he saw my drinking as fairly social, nothing extraordinary. A girl who likes to get a little tipsy rather than a girl who needs to get hammered. He had no idea how much I really drank. That was the first big lie, probably the main one. We'd go out to dinner together, and I'd drink what seemed like a reasonable amount, 3 glasses of wine, maybe 4. He just wouldn't see the 4 or 5 more I drank after he dropped me off at my apartment. I didn't get seriously bombed in front of him for a long time, and the few times I did, he didn't know me well enough to tell. I hid the relationship with Julian well, too. Michael knew I'd been living with him, and he knew we still saw each other sometimes, but I minimized the extent of my involvement. One night early on, Michael came over to my apartment while I was on the phone with Julian, engaged in a long verbal brawl. He sat on the sofa for about 30 minutes trying not to listen, but after I got off the phone, he looked up from his magazine and said, "That is one sick relationship. Do you know that?" He looked alarmed, more alarmed than he sounded, and after that I started unplugging the phone when he came over. I unplugged the phone when Julian came over, too. Dramas spiral and twist. Lies feed on one another. I still coveted Julian's approval, and I still believed that the deterioration of the relationship was my fault. And the more time I spent with Michael, the guiltier I felt around Julian. I felt dishonorable and evil. A person who had no business expecting good things from a relationship. And as that feeling deepened, the harder it got to be straight with either one of them. I lived this way for longer than I care to admit, a downward spiral lubricated by drink, made bearable by anesthesia. I lied to both men all the time, and I drank even more because the duplicity made me so uncomfortable. Julian and I would be making plans to get together, and he'd say, "How about Wednesday?" And I'd be seeing Michael that night, so I'd say, "Oh, I'm having dinner with Eliza on Wednesday." Or Michael and I would be making plans, and I'd say, "I really need a night alone just to veg out," and then I'd go off to dinner with Julian. Often I didn't lie so much as I withheld information or manipulated facts, and I suppose that helped me rationalize the behavior. I'd drop just enough information about each man to the other to protect myself from being totally dishonest, but I limited degrees, never revealed the true extent of either involvement, maintained an illusion of availability in both relationships that truly didn't exist. The truth is, I didn't know how to be real, how to tell the truth. My whole sense of reality was tied into the deception. To be honest would have meant dismantling the whole structure, all the assumptions and impressions about myself I'd worked so hard to create. I'm together. I'm in control. I'm the person you want me to be. To tell the truth would have meant disclosing my full self, owning up to flaws and imperfections and depths of confusion I was too ashamed to reveal. I am not in control at all. I am deeply fucked up. A whole lot of alcoholics know this state of mind. It's like living in a house of cards and feeling that if you remove one of them, own up to one lie, the whole thing will crumble down around you. About a year into this drama, I got pregnant. I didn't know which one was the father. Michael came with me the day I got the pregnancy test. I told Julian I wanted to go by myself. And Julian came with me the day I had the abortion. I told Michael that Eliza was coming with me. And neither one knew beans about the other one's involvement. No one did. I didn't tell a soul except these two men that I'd gone and gotten myself knocked up, which is exactly what I felt I'd done. I blamed it all on diaphragm failure at the time, but I'm quite sure it was drunken negligence, pure and simple. The morning of the abortion, I had to have a brief counseling session with a member of the staff, a kind, heavy-set woman whose job was to make sure I knew what I was doing, what my options were. She took me into a little room and closed the door. "How are you feeling?" she asked. I hadn't shed a tear up to that point, but my eyes welled up just then, and I said I felt rotten. I said, "I wish I was at a point in my life where having a baby was an option, but it just isn't right now." And that's when I got choked up. I felt sorry for myself and ashamed and just plain overwhelmed that I'd gotten drunk one night, which night I couldn't even remember, and accidentally created a life. I had that sensation of wanting desperately to be some other person, some other kind of person, a clean-living, monogamous woman who lived in a farmhouse somewhere and had baby after baby with no doubts or complications. Shortly after the abortion, Julian and I stopped sleeping together. We never talked about this. Our relationship just took an unspoken turn and entered into even more ambiguous territory, as though we both silently and simultaneously signed an agreement, dismissing sexual intimacy without quite letting go of our attachment. I suppose I was relieved at the change. It eased my guilt a shade, gave me one less thing to be caught at. My father got sick about a year after the abortion, and I started spending more nights at Michael's apartment, partly because he lived near my parents and partly because he was a comfort I needed. Gradually, I took to hiding liquor. I'd stop at a liquor store on my way over to pick up wine for dinner, and I'd see those little nips of liquor by the cash register, and I'd think, insurance, just in case I feel I need it. Nips of cognac in the purse, nips in the drawer at Michael's where I kept my stuff, nips transferred surreptitiously to my bathrobe pockets so I could sip one or two in the bathroom before I went to bed, to help me sleep. At some point, I don't remember when, it got too embarrassing to stand there in the liquor store every other day and ask for two or three nips of brandy, so I bought a whole bottle and stashed it out on Michael's back porch. I knew this was wrong. I knew it was the kind of thing alcoholics did. But after a while, even hiding booze started to seem natural, justifiable. Certainly it seemed situational. I was so depressed. My family was falling apart, and I was all tangled up with Julian, and I was so stressed out, and I figured I'd stop all this at some point down the line. I'd stop it when things got better. I hated myself for living like this, the hiding, the duplicity, the plotting and racing around. It was exhausting. Sometimes I felt like a fly trapped in a small glass jar, batting about in my own life in a panic. But that only added to the deepening feeling of need around alcohol. Liquor, slowly but surely, became the sole source of relief from my own thoughts. And so it goes. You lie and you deflect blame and you rationalize, and the hole you dig yourself gets deeper and deeper. Denial, first of drinking, then of the self, stretches to include more and more bits of reality. And after a while, you literally cannot see the truth, can't see your own role in the disaster you've made of your life, can't see who you are or what you need or what choices you have. During that period, juggling both relationships, my life took on a deeply fragmented quality, with different persona emerging and becoming more distinct and also more false. At work, I was the composed writer and editor, and at Julian's house, I was the sophisticated, well-dressed intellectual. And at Michael's house, I was the slightly needy girlfriend, and at home, I didn't know who the hell I was. Which thread led to the real me? After my father died, the drinking increased. I was aware of this, but I used his death and my mother's subsequent illness to justify it. Of course I'm drinking. My father's dead and my mother's dying. Of course I'm stuck in these two relationships. I can't take on another loss right now. Of course I'm a wreck. My life's in a shambles. In reality, though, the drinking merely complicated the sense of fragmentation, contributed to the gradual loss of control. And that's precisely how drinking works. Your life gets ugly and you drink more. You drink more and your life gets uglier still. The cycle goes on and on and on, and in the process you become increasingly isolated and lost, stuck in your own circle of duplicity and rationalization and confusion. Alcoholics drink in order to ease the very pain that drinking helps create. That's another one of the great puzzles behind liquor, the great paradoxes. You hurt, you drink. You hurt some more, you up the intake. In the process, of course, you lose any chance you might have had to heal authentically. Years later, I'd hear people in AA say it over and over, unmanageable, my life was unmanageable, and still I wouldn't quite see how the word applied to me. In fact, unmanageability was the story of my life. I was living in a state of self-imposed chaos, lying and hiding and keeping secrets and feeling trapped, absolutely trapped, in the whole mess. One night in the rehab, I spent some time sitting in the cafeteria with a man named George, who had a drinking history somewhat like my own. He'd never gotten himself into too much trouble. He still had a job and an apartment, and he still had friends and the trappings of a normal, non-ravaged life. And we sat around for a while talking about what it means to hit bottom and whether or not we really had. You know, George said, I never did those things you associate with real alcoholics. I never totaled a car, ended up in jail. I never killed anyone in a blackout. I didn't have those kinds of losses. I nodded, me neither. The question, George says, is how low do you have to go before you quit? How bad do things really have to get? A little while later, a man named Chris joined us, and we asked him what he thought. How low, how bad before you give it up? Chris is a heavy-set construction worker in his early 30s with bright blue eyes and arms like telephone poles. He said, well, I guess really hitting bottom means death. It's a question of getting off the elevator before you get that far down. The elevator metaphor is common in AA. The alcoholic's elevator only goes in one direction, straight down. The good news is you can get off any time you want. After you've truly accepted that you're a member of the crowd, after you've gotten scared or desperate enough to see what direction you're headed, it's a choice you make. Get off or keep going until you end up 6 feet under. My friend Abby got on the elevator after she was raped. Who could blame her? Wouldn't you do the same? Abby drank a lot before this happened, and she smoked pot daily. But after the rape, something within her shifted. The impulse to control and to worry abated. Fuck it. It's like the deepest part of your soul just says that. Fuck it. And you plunge, justification in hand like a passport to self-destruction. Abby lived in a basement apartment. She started stealing bottles of wine from the landlord's wine cellar, which was adjacent to her front door. And she drank every night until she passed out. My friend Janet took the leap after her marriage ended. Something clicked the same way. Something very deep said, nope, just can't tolerate any more pain. And her alcohol intake went off the charts. In itself, I suppose, the plunge is about drowning, about wanting to drown, about needing the perfect excuse to let go of the lifeboat. But plunging isn't the same as hitting bottom. truly landing with such finality you realize you have to get off the damn elevator or you'll die, requires an elusive combination of despair and grace, something known in AA as the gift of desperation. Reality sets in at last, chips away at denial. Some of us lose our jobs or our spouses or our children. Some of us get into car wrecks and are ordered by judges to go to AA. For a man I know named Richard, hitting bottom meant reaching a level of self-loathing so deep that all he wanted to do was kill himself, and then hating himself even more because he didn't have the guts to do it. For a man named Troy, hitting bottom meant looking up from his chair one day and realizing that the only two things he had in his life were a 12-inch black and white TV and a bottle of gin, the props of pure isolation. For my friend Ginny, it meant losing control in the most literal sense, driving too fast down a winding road in the middle of the night, careening off the road, flying through the windshield of her car head first. She surrendered just before her head hit the glass. "Okay," she whispered, letting go of the wheel. "I give up." These are all people in their 30s with good jobs and intact families. Richard is an urban planner. Troy is an English professor. Ginny's a lawyer. If you saw them on the street, even while they were drinking, you'd never know a thing. Hitting bottom is usually something that happens internally, where no one else can see it. My own descent had the feel of a swan dive, a long, slow, curving arc, the outlines of which I was able to see only in retrospect. My father died and I jumped off the deep end. A year later, my mother died and I continued to fall, blindly and willingly. 10 months after that, I landed in a rehab. Perhaps my father could see this, could see that his death would have the power to force certain choices in my life. He might not have known that those choices would have to do with alcohol, but he understood that losing him would have to change me. As he put it to me himself, quite bluntly, losing a parent is a life-altering event. He said this in May of 1991, several days after being diagnosed with a brain tumor. He was lying in bed at the New England Medical Center in Boston, and I was perched at the edge, staring down at my hands. A moment passed in silence, and then I looked at him. He appeared unaltered. He was 74 by then, and still sharp as a tack, energetic and driven. So it was surreal to be sitting with him in a hospital room, trying to wrap my mind around his diagnosis. He hadn't yet had the biopsy to confirm it. That would take place in a day or two. But the doctors knew. The MRI had shown a glioblastoma, a large, particularly aggressive grade of tumor located in the center of his brain, an inoperable site. He'll lose function in his legs, his arms, and his hands. A neurology resident told us this several days earlier. Then he'll lose his speech. He'll become disoriented and confused. His thought patterns will become more scattered. He'll get more and more apathetic. And ultimately, he'll die. I don't think the doctor actually used those words, but he didn't have to. Brain tumor, death. The equation was clear, hopeless, and as my father said, life-altering. My father died on April 7, 1992. 1 year and 11 days later, on April 18, 1993, my mother died of metastatic breast cancer. I was 32 when I lost my father, 33 when I lost my mother. Now I'm 36. In the aftermath of their deaths, I finally lost my childhood. Along with it, I suppose, I began to lose my capacity for denial, too. So my father was right. Losing a parent is a life-altering experience. It would just take me several years to figure out exactly how. In the months after my father's diagnosis, I'd leave work most days at 5 or 5:30, go across the street to the Aku, and drink two stiff scotches. Then I'd stop at a liquor store near my parents' house in Cambridge, buy a six-pack of beer and bring two of the bottles into their house with me. I'd drink one, then wait half an hour or so and drink the other, and I'd sit with my parents, sometimes visiting alone with my father so my mother could get out of the house. After I'd had both beers, I'd move surreptitiously to the hard liquor. My parents would be in the bedroom toward the back of the house, and I'd go off to smoke a cigarette, which I always did outside. I don't remember the first time I passed the liquor cabinet on my way to the front door and decided to stop there first. I don't remember taking that first bottle of Old Granddad from the cabinet and carrying it with me to the front stoop. I don't remember the rationale, but I must have come up with one. I should keep this bottle handy. Maybe I should stash it behind the toilet in the front hall bathroom, or tuck it inside the basket full of old sporting equipment in the closet. At some point, Hiding the booze must have seemed like a good idea because I did it. And then the liquor was there for me whenever I needed it, which was often. The logic seemed sound at the time, and I used it daily for nearly 3 years. Illness, loss, another illness, another loss. Watching me, an outsider could draw a direct line between my parents' deaths and the escalation of drinking that led me to rehab. And in some ways, that line would accurately reflect what happened. Those losses provided just the excuse I needed to make the jump. My father's illness was long and gruesome, the brain tumor gradually shutting down one system after another, just as the doctor predicted. My mother's illness, following so closely on the heels of his, had the quality of a nightmare. More hospitals, more tests, more anxious phone calls. During both illnesses and after both deaths, I drank with the no-holes-barred abandon of the truly self-pitying drinker every night until I passed out. Yet when I really look back over that period, the 2 consecutive years of hospitalizations and hospice and horror, what stands out are a few key scenes, ones that had less to do with the facts of illness and loss than with what I was forced to see through those experiences about myself. About 2 months after my dad's diagnosis, a morning in July of 1991, my sister Becca and I were sitting in our parents' living room and we heard them arguing in their bedroom. A few minutes passed. Then my mother came down the stairs toward us, looking flushed and angry. She didn't confide in us much about personal matters, but we dragged the details out of her. Apparently, my father had delivered what he called a deathbed confession, although many months would pass before he actually died. The confession was about the affair that had nearly broken up their marriage 10 years earlier. He'd allegedly broken off the relationship at that time, and my mother spent the next decade assuming the affair was over. She'd ask him about it periodically, and he'd reassure her, still over, no contact with the other woman. But he'd been lying. The affair had continued without interruption all that time. That woman, my mother always called her that woman, had been to visit him in the hospital just weeks earlier. Becca and I spent the day trying to calm things down, one of us talking to our mother in the living room, the other talking to our father in the bedroom, then switching rooms and parents. My mother was just plain furious, her mouth a sharp line all day long and her eyes burning. My father was more confused. I gathered he'd hoped the confession would relieve him of guilt and lead to forgiveness, and he kept saying, "When the chips were down, your mother always came first," as though that somehow explained or excused the betrayal. Becca and I both left the house early that evening, having eked a promise out of my father that he'd talk to a therapist about all this. We left them both sitting at the dining room table just staring at the walls, a silence so heavy it felt like humidity. That evening, a few drinks in me, I called my own therapist and told him what had happened. He asked, "How does this situation affect you?" And at the time I thought that was kind of an inane question. Who cares about me? What about them? But later that night I thought about a conversation I'd had with my father several months earlier. I'd been particularly depressed one day, and I'd come over to the house to talk to him, wanting support. I talked to him in a general way about Julian and Michael, my ambivalence, my duplicity, my feeling of being stuck in both relationships and incapable of being honest, and I started to cry. "I don't know what to do," I said. "I feel like such a mess." I was hoping for sympathy, but instead my father got angry at me, surprisingly so. He didn't mention my drinking, but he touched, at least indirectly, on its effects. He said, "This is all a giant procrastination. There is a split within you, and you must deal with it. You must." Until he made the confession to my mother, I didn't know just how intimately he understood that sort of split, how deeply and for how long he'd lived it himself. Although she took care of him until he died, my mother never quite forgave my father for his betrayal, and he never really forgave himself. He died believing in his soul that he'd somehow brought the brain tumor on himself. He told my mother that its location, in the exact center of his brain, was a psychosomatic representation of his own unresolvable conflict. I thought about that conversation with my father for a long time that night, and many more times during and after his illness. In a way, in his own oblique, analytical manner, he'd handed me a gift, a glimpse of foresight.